This week's show with Don Cook Ronigan is sponsored by Sassy Jack Stitchery and Avlia Folk Embroidery. In addition to the new Nashville market releases, Sassy Jack's is your source for the full line of reproduction samplers from Barbara Hudson of Queenstown Sampler Designs. Now through April 30, you can get 10% off all Queenstown charts and kits with the code FiberTalk10. That's all one word, FiberTalk and the number 10. If you want a kit, order your charts and note in the order form comment section that you want kits, and Kim will contact you to arrange ground cloth and threads. Also, visit the workshop section to sign up for the Summer House Stitchworks event, August 4 to 5, and the September Soiree online retreat, September 15 to 18. Make Sassy Jack Stitchery your local needlework store by visiting the website at sassyjackstitchery.com. Avlia Folk Embroidery is also sponsoring this week's show. Designer Krista West continues to deliver exciting new designs. The Cypress and Hollyhock Table Runner has just been released on 30-count Greek linen in vanilla, and it features classic motifs from Greek folk embroidery. The new Peloponnesian Poppies Table Runner on traditional ground cloth features a classic urn design filled with vibrant red poppies. It's a quick stitch. The Ionian Apron Kit, originally designed for Taproot Magazine, is now off copyright and will be released at the Avlia website this month. The kit includes the embroidery fabric, floss, and the Essex cotton linen for the apron, along with complete sewing instructions. Also, meet Krista at the HH Americas Trade Show in June and the International Quilt Market in October. Thanks to Sassy Jack Stitchery and Avlia Folk Embroidery for sponsoring this week's show. Now enjoy our conversation with Dawn Cook Ronigan. Our topic is her new book, Sewing Rolls, Needle Rolls, and Huswifts, and it's available from Sassy Jack Stitchery and many other local needlework shops. Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Dawn Cook Ronigan, for the third time. We've done three shows with you. So Dawn, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
Oh, fun to talk to you. All right. So the last time it was your new book, Antique American Needlework Tools. And go get that book, folks. Go get that book. It is, you will use it time after time. It's so much fun to look through. But now Dawn has a new book, Sewing Rolls, Needle Rolls, and Huswifts. Is that how? We're going to talk about the book. But the biggest question is, it Huswifts, Housewives? What is that thing?
It's all of the above. I spend a page in the book talking about all the different terminology and pronunciation. So it all works depending on what century, what country, what spelling you're using. It all works.
Okay. Yeah. Because when I read that, it's like, okay, it's pick your poison. But I thought there's got to be a preferred way here somewhere. But it just depends on where you're at.
Yeah.
And is that saying it correctly when you say Huswifts?
Some people say Huswif, and I had someone last month using a British accent, and it sounded so cool, and I can't do that accent, but yeah, that's close.
Okay. Yeah, now I got to hear somebody British say it, because it probably is very cool.
Yeah. Yes, of course.
Huswif, I think she.
Huswif?
Huswif, yeah.
Huswif. Yeah, I can see them saying that. Oh, now we got to get a British person. Okay.
Right.
We'll recruit someone. That'll be the first question the next time we interview someone from the UK. Pronounce this for us just so we can enjoy it. Okay.
Yes, please. That's totally nuts.
All right, so this is a fairly narrow aspect of needlework, but and until I got the book, I didn't appreciate how cool all these sewing rolls and needle rolls are. Do you collect these just like you do needlework tools? Is it just part of your ongoing deal?
Yeah, I kind of consider them almost an extension of my collection. I do talk about them in the first book. But I'm learning recently that a lot of people that I assumed knew what they were not aware of them, which is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard of huswus. Now I'm going to stumble over that every time. But the sewing rolls and needle rolls, yeah, news to me.
Yeah, and they go back, you know, centuries. So, and when you're immersed in collecting, my mind just assumed that everybody knows all about these.
I just didn't realize there were so many different categories of them. You know, that's what surprised me.
Yeah. So as I was collecting, I maintain a database because I'm going to tell on myself, but I also have a collection of leather sewing rolls and leather needle rolls, which are I didn't put in the book. But so I have several hundred in my database, and I was trying to find some maybe regional styles or styles by country or ways to kind of categorize and further study them. And they're really very, very creatively made. So it's really hard to categorize them because they are so unique.
So they were mainly made by individuals then? They were like,
yes.
Not as much mass produced?
Correct. Not until we get into the 20th century, which was kind of out of scope for this book. And then they were sometimes kind of mass produced or made the same design and style in large quantities for resale. But I tried to focus on the earlier ones, and then I tried to look at the aspects of their construction and what they're made of. And tell about those. So not everything made it in the book, but quite a variety.
So taking us back, and I follow a lady on Instagram, Isabella Pitcher, who makes historic clothing. And one of the things I did not know about those massive dresses that the women wore back then was then they would have these side pockets, and then they would have these little bags under their dress that they would haul all manner of things. And so,
yeah.
so this is where those would go?
Most frequently, yes. Yeah. So the ladies tie on waist pockets. I have a collection of those as well.
Of course you do.
And the yeah, and well, the embroidered ones are beautiful. But and it wouldn't be that uncommon for women to wear multiple pockets. And there's entire books written on pockets, so why not have a book on sewing rolls? Men carried them as well. They slip into a small pocket, or when they're tied closed, they can mix in a large pocket with other items. Those ladies' waist pockets might have things like keys, items for babies, maybe a baby bib, all kinds of things that a woman through the course of her day might need access to. And a sewing roll would be just one of those items.
So under those big dresses, it's a small hardware store.
Yeah, think of a woman's purse and how much you could unload. I know mine, you can unload out of a purse for the things that you need through the course of a day. And people could have more than one sewing roll as well. You might have one that was more darning and mending supplies. You might have one that was more for your embroidery or other kinds of work. So it didn't mean you had just one, just like the pockets.
Yeah. And the other thing I took out of this, well, several things, but that really stood out was I got a sense of the importance of needle and thread in daily life. Just because people
yeah.
go to trouble of making these things and carrying them around.
The examples in this book represent a time when all clothing was made by hand. The majority of these are pre-sewing machine. Not all. But the majority, it represents all those stitches, I mean, all that handwork that had to be done to clothe a family, let alone your own person, and then maintaining the clothing or embroideries or whatever work you were doing. So they were significantly important. And just the value of textiles at that time, the value of pins and needles, it really tells us a lot about material history.
So do you think most of them were made out of like scraps of like leftovers? Or did it just depend on the era?
I think it more so depended on the maker. There were women's organizations, even going back to the Civil War, where women would gather together and make these and send them in quantities off to soldiers. A soldier was essential that they kept their uniform and their socks and everything in working order. Nothing's worse than being miserable with blisters or a coat that won't close. They were sometimes lined with fabrics or embroideries that were representative of social occasions. So you could open it up and think about a special dress or a color or something that was had special meaning to you. And fabric was very expensive, so it represented people saved it more and valued it more than they do today.
Yeah, that fabric thing really comes through looking at the pictures. You can see it just, to me, it was like old-fashioned quilts where you repurpose clothes and fabric again and again and again, because a lot of those, it looked like, you know, I got a piece of this and a piece of this, and these colors kind of go together, and so we'll make it out of this. And then some are, you know, clearly they had the money in the fabric to put together some coordinated thing. But, yeah, it seemed like a lot of cases, it was a lot of patchwork. Use the fabric we have.
And those are in high contrast to similarly examples in the embroidery chapter, where someone had the means to do something in highly coordinated silks in very sophisticated patterns. So there's quite a contrast of styles.
Yeah, those were beautiful. Those really drew my eye, those embroidered ones that you showed.
Yeah, when you got to that chapter, it was, all right, we just went a step up or two in class, and, you know, just in terms of wealth and well-being, you could just tell these are people who had a little bit of money to put into these things.
Yeah, or sent their girls to very nice schools with a lot of resources to make those.
Yeah. Yep. No, it's an interesting little tour through history. That's the thing, you wouldn't think that you could get so much history out of sewing rolls and huswifts, but yeah, you could just see the history and the different levels in society, whether it be lower class or whatever. You could start to pick them out as you study the book. Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, and you can't always tell from the look of the roll. In some cases, I was able to do some genealogy and research, the owner, possibly the maker. And so, for example, one of the velvet and silk ones that probably one could call elegantly Victorian, it turned out to belong to a woman who, you know, didn't have any modern conveniences. At 83 years old, she was still shoveling coal and raising her own food and butchering her own chickens. And so sometimes you couldn't always tell the economic status of a maker or owner of the roll.
Hmm.
Okay. The other thing I found interesting was the fabric. When you have those close-up pictures, you showed how the fabric was block printed, you know, like it was like that it wasn't quite set correctly on the printing. And I found that interesting, because I never thought about that all those had to be kind of hand printed. We're so used to seeing everything exactly correct on our fabrics.
Yeah, those 18th century ones, sometimes they would even do the block printing and go back through. It was called penciling, and they would actually hand paint some of the details in, depending on the maker of the fabric. So that was part of what made the fabric so expensive, is they were very labor intensive to get those designs and colors.
And to see those little scraps, though, on the different sewing rolls was interesting. You know, I just never, you know, because then you could really see the detail of it, because they only had like a little square or whatever on there and a little piece of it. And that really showed how expensive, how time-consuming fabric was to make, I guess. And I just, I forget all the time.
Yeah, I was very lucky to get some nice high-resolution photography, which was one of my goals, was to show people the details if they haven't had the opportunity to see very many of these, if any at all, up close, is they could look at the high-resolution photography and really get a sense of seeing it in person.
Yeah, that value of the fabric, but also the needles, because the first time there was a mention in the book of needle pages, I thought, oh, this will be interesting. And then it's just this little tiny scrap of felt at the bottom with one or two needles in it. You know, when I look at the needle book I have, which is just full of needles, and it just kind of stopped me, like, wow, these, even the needles had to be incredibly valuable to them, like guard them with your life.
Yeah, they were likely more highly regarded than we are today. I mean, I think most of us don't think much of tossing a needle and getting a fresh needle out. And then other tools like bodkins or small things like that, that we needed to keep, they needed to keep close at hand, and we just take them for granted.
Yeah, we do. Cause I mean, that was a couple of those needles even looked rather crude, and I thought, wow, they, you know, just hang on to this thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, some of these would be in at the era where needles were handmade one at a time, and those eyes were hand punched, and they were often made by women and children in not very nice conditions. Mm. And they weren't always great quality. Sometimes they are, but these 18th century ones could be resharpened and reused and kept for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just these little cloth roll-up things are just a real view into history if you take a moment to look at them and get a real sense of what women, well, and soldiers too, men, you know, this is what the life was like, was to have these things and sit here in this room with fabric and charts and stuff everywhere, and these people had these little rolls that they carried around, and I'm sure made darn sure they knew where they were at all times. Yeah.
Yeah. And their sense of privacy and personal space was different as well. It's not that uncommon to find something like a little lock of hair or a personal note tucked inside. So they were a way to keep some keepsakes private as well.
Yeah, you had a couple of notes in there that you found, a couple of personal items in there and some threads. What kinds of things? Is it common to find extra things in these when you collect them?
Yeah, so I always check the pockets partially just to see if it's maybe evidence of the age of the item. But there's often threads. One had a feather and a little piece of leather. And some of the attributions I don't always trust, because sometimes people make up stories or family stories aren't necessarily factual stories. But I do always try and do the genealogy and research when I have a name and see if it makes sense with the dates. So yeah, there's lots of mysteries, but then lots of clues that can help you solve a mystery as well.
Yeah. Going through these, you know, I thought about Beth a lot when I was reading the book with all these fabrics and the dyeing. You must, Don, you must really get start to develop a real sense of fabric quality and printing and craftsmanship just in making the fabrics, and then through the years see the quality improve or maybe deteriorate?
Yeah, I think it goes both ways. And I think that's even true with today's fabrics. We've never stopped experimenting with dyes and printing processes and how we're manufacturing fabric. And it isn't always for the better. And sometimes we learn that earlier processes were better. So it does lead you into the technology of printed fabrics and dating fabrics and learning about textiles.
So can you tell when you like pick up a piece if the fabric is older, or are there lots of clues, more than just the feel or the look? Or is it a combination, I guess?
I think it's a combination of many things. It depends on the size of the piece, if you have a repeat to look at, what's the distance of the repeat, how consistent is the printing from motif to motif, if it is a repeat, looking at all the other clues, how it was sewn together. It would take an entire checklist to really. In some cases, I did put dates on when I could find a particular mill sample or something that I could accurately pinpoint it to. But often I just applied a circa date. Things like velvets and woven checks are incredibly difficult to date. Sometimes you could look at a really unique process like that botanical one that was done with the ink splattering process.
Yes.
Yeah, that one, you know, I was able to find when American magazines were giving instructions to do that. And given the technique and the way it was made, it made sense that it's in that era. So then I just put the circa date that kind of followed that kind of trend.
I have to tell you, I already can tell that my friends and I are going to try that this spring. We're going to get our India ink and a toothbrush and a screen and see if we can replicate that. That's going to be on the to-do list once we get some more flowers.
I have some smaller, you have to press them. I have some smaller pieces, like pin cushions and things that were done with it. So I know that it was a popular thing, and there's surely more pieces out there. And interestingly, all the pieces I found in my collection have the blue ribbon binding.
Hmm.
Maybe like, I don't know, blue skies with the flowers. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Or was the ink, too, like you can get ink in all sorts of colors now, but maybe the choice of colors wasn't a lot. I don't know.
There was ink in lots of colors, I think.
Okay.
It was just probably more a matter of accessibility. If you think back to even ancient Chinese pieces that were painted silk with inks, there were lots and lots of colors, but maybe where they were, there wasn't, or maybe they were trying to get the sepia tones of a photograph. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to hear about your experiment.
Yeah, I can't wait. I just need to get flowers.
I knew when I'm going through the book, I knew Beth's mind was just reeling with ideas for printing and dyeing fabrics and seeing all these examples.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and you can imagine if you had limited choices in, let's say, a mid-19th century mercantile or some small town, and you go in and you see yardage of, like, turkey red for the first time, you know, you can imagine how exciting that would be to see that and be able to have it in your home, and whether it was a yard or, you know, 7 yards, how exciting that would be.
Right. Absolutely. Or even just some of those printed ones, if you could get just a small piece of it, or you bought some for something and you would save all those little scraps and use them.
Or you got a letter from a relative saying, I made a new dress and here's a little sample of what my new dress looks like. And every time you saw that little square, you'd think of that person. Right. We don't do things like that now.
Nope.
No, we don't.
No. And the other thing that on all of these that initially I thought, oh, these are quick stitch, throw together things. They're functional. They wear out. We throw them away. And then you kept giving us examples that had been handed down sometimes three generations. These were treasured items.
They were. And the fact that they were kept, even in the condition that they were in, I wanted to show that. I wanted to show that just because you have a textile or come across a textile that's exhibiting wear or has been mended, it doesn't mean it's any less worthy of collecting. I think it tells more of a story. Oftentimes I could peek inside and see what the layers were made of. And I had no qualms at all about including less than what some people might call perfect examples in the book, because I think that's an important part of the story.
Now, do you take them apart ever to see how, what they're made from?
I haven't taken one apart. I have some where like a seam has popped and I've kind of, you know, peeked inside the seam to check an interlining or see what the interiors are like. I have done museum studies where I do an appointment and I go and I see their collection, but you don't touch those.
Right.
So you can't determine, oh, did they use a lining inside the pocket on that silk embroidery? By today's means, if we took a workshop and we made some beautiful silk piece and they said, oh, but we're not going to line it, you would be like so concerned because everything has to be lined, right? And none of the silk ones that I've seen are lined.
What was interesting was you found that piece of cardboard inside with the from the cereal box. And it made me think of all the ornaments I've made. I used, you know, cereal boxes. And, you know, when my kids were little, that's how I finished my ornaments. And it made me happy to see that, you know, somebody used a cereal box and it still lasted. But did you find a lot like that?
Yeah, I don't think there was a lot written about archival materials. In this particular example, I believe that the fabric deteriorated because of what the silk was treated with and not so much the lithography on the cardstock. And I'm not by any means advocating that you shouldn't use archival material. I try to as well. But I think examples like this demonstrate, and I was able to date it by looking at the lithography, the print process, finding the serial brand, and that's what helped me get the 1920 date on it. So over 100 years ago, and it's lasted. And granted, the silk is worn, but what silk did, because it was treated with mineral salts that deteriorated the silk fiber. It had nothing to do with the paper. So it does teach us things about how they were made and how they stood the test of time and storage and care of our needlework.
And it also makes you a bit of a detective too, because of all the research you had to do on the cereal box then.
Yeah, so you do a deep dive and you start learning about side topics like lithography, the history of colored printing, when cereal boxes started being printed in color, all the kinds of things I didn't put in the book, but you kind of go down that rabbit hole when you're trying to get some dates, especially on a solid colored silk and a solid colored velvet. When you think you have a ballpark date, this just helps kind of narrow down the date.
Oh, the hours that must go into the research, because I imagine, you start headed down another path like printing, and then hours later you've learned all these things and can't use them in the book, but they're good to know. Yep.
Yeah, they're up there somewhere if I never need to pull them out again. But yeah, and I would venture to say if I could see inside these, anything that's paper reinforced, that it is not archival at all.
Yeah. Where are you finding these things? Are you a lot of estate sales, pounding through antique stores?
Everywhere is fair game. We love antique shopping. We like auctions, estate sales. I was doing a presentation one time to a group of textile enthusiasts and antique dealers, and I made the mistake of saying it's really almost impossible to find a sewing roll with a full name and date on it. I've never seen it. And after the talk, someone comes up to the podium and says, I have something I think you're going to want to see. So what, and that's where Sarah Morehouse came from. And her full name and date is on her sewing roll. Because of course I had to buy it because I'd never seen one like it. But yeah, so sometimes they kind of come to you. And especially once the book's been out, I've had a lot of people contact me and not necessarily to buy their sewing rolls, but just to share what they have. And I get it added in the database, and it just helps add to the knowledge base about these little treasures.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. You know, these are textiles, so they will eventually disintegrate, you know, go away, especially without care. But having this book, we've got a visual of them. So if something should happen, heaven forbid, you know, fire, whatever, the book documents them. At least gives you something to look back at and say, oh, that's what those are. That's what that looks like.
Yeah. And I do archival storage of them. I have them, I buy museum quality archival boxes and acid free tissue, and they don't touch each other in their little boxes. And the boxes are labeled so I can pull them out as needed for various programs and that. But then I also can just pop into my Dropbox and look at a picture if I need something for a program or something I'm putting together. So having them documented is very, very helpful.
What keeps you from buying everyone you encounter? There must be some criteria.
My budget.
Oh, okay.
On any given day, I would say, you know, I don't think I could just go out and find one to buy. Like even at auction, they don't always come up. So I would say they're getting harder and harder to find. And I also like to see them in person first, because there are some relatively good reproductions out in the marketplace.
Yeah, I wanted to learn about that. That sounded like something you really got to be aware of all the time.
Yeah, and when you buy at auction and you only have pictures, you know, there's always risk in that. And I did buy an auction lot, I don't know, a couple of years ago. I think there were several in there, and I could tell some were pretty bogus, but a couple of them looked really good. And so I thought, well, if they all end up being fakes, I can use them in my program and, you know, show different features of them. And they came, and the couple that I thought were probably pretty legitimate, I still think that. And then a couple that I knew were fakes are just so bad, they're hysterical. And I'm actually going to use one of them in one of my programs. It doesn't even have a pocket. They're like fake pockets. But you can't tell that from the picture. And I don't know if the maker did that not knowing what they really were, just kind of looking and thinking, you know, I just put these bands of fabric across this. I don't know, but I think it's going to make for a funny little portion of the program. But I look for them all over.
Oh man, there's got to be fakes in everything. It just, everybody's got to try it. Yeah.
Yeah. I talked to one dealer a few years ago, and she stopped carrying them. She stopped buying them because she can't tell them. And she, for the price, it's too risky. Because they're small, you don't need a lot of antique fabric to make them. Mm-hmm. So that gives people the material, to reproduce them. You can get old thread, so you can't even necessarily look for a phosphorescence under a black light. So yeah, it can be risky. I think the last chapter with all the embroidered ones, those would be much, much more difficult to make look old. So those I have less hesitancy on, but the cotton ones probably are the ones that are the most reproduced.
Yeah. Talk about the instructions, because you mentioned up front that the instructions for making these things were rather abbreviated. Everybody just kind of knew how to do them, so they didn't really need to write down instructions.
Yeah, so if you were lucky, I think like by 1835 or so, some of the ladies' magazines would have like a line drawing, and it would just say maybe 8 sentences, you know, cut a length of fabric, add a pocket, finish the edge, and make a closure. And so everything in between was up to you. And however you learned. So maybe your way of hemming was a rolled hem. Maybe you preferred a trim or a binding. Maybe you wanted your pocket really big, or you wanted several small ones. I mean, that's why I think we see so many creative ways these are made, which is part of the reason I find them so endearing.
Right. And see, and I've looked at making one, and it's like, okay, I know it can't be that hard. It's just the length of fabric. You're making pockets, you know, a simple design, maybe a needle book in there. And I'm like, why do I feel like I need to have it all spelled out for me? You know, obviously these people that made all these did not have all this detailed instruction. I just need to just do it.
Yeah, and when you get to a point and it's like, you know, bind it, and you're like, well, I'm not sure. You just make it up as you go. And like the corners, people today like, oh, you must miter the corner. It must be at a 45-degree angle. You must tack the 45-degree corner. I mean, we have all these rules that somebody made up. And we don't have to follow those. None of these follow those rules. None of these are double fold cotton bias bindings. So somewhere along the line, someone made up the pattern and said, so that's the rule. And it became the rule. I don't know.
Yeah. We feel like we've got to follow those rules instead of just saying, okay, I'm just going to make it. I'm just going to make one.
Yeah, because we don't want someone to look at ours and say, you know, why did you just ease that fullness around the corner and not do a precise 45-degree corner? And I think we should be okay to say, because that's what I wanted to do that day. I mean, really, in the whole scheme of things, it doesn't really matter.
Right. You know, and I think they were looking more at functionality and using what they had.
Yeah. And I think today someone would argue and say, oh, yes, but, you know, double fold bias binding lasts much longer. And I would say, OK, well, you know, I'm not going to wash this every week with my bedding. I don't want the bulk. I want it nice and light. And, you know, these obviously held up 150 years or more. And in some cases, the silk and different things didn't wear as well. So, I think we can take more liberties maybe when we do our finishing.
Right.
Yeah, see, and that was going through my mind too, Beth, was, hey, it'd be fun to make one of these things. But I had that same moment where, yeah, but I need a pattern and some instructions. How do I, you know, start? And
we started a pattern series for more of the unusual ones, so like the thread channels and things that people may be less familiar with reproducing, and we've done those as digital patterns. And then I have the charts and the models ready for the embroidered ones in the back. I just need to finish covers. Well, actually, I think I do have the Arbel one. It's done and available for people. And the finishing, people don't accept it if you just say bind it however you like. So they're rather long, but my personal feeling is bind it however you want. but we had to pick one way to put in the pattern, which we did. And if you look at the picture, you can see that she's got one corner that looks kind of pointy and the other one looks kind of round. And people may or may not like that. I kind of like it because I think it's historically accurate. But it's all a choice.
Okay, I missed that. So we can actually get patterns then.
Yes. Yeah, so I have, I say I, but it's really we. My daughter helps with these. We have two that are out live that are PDF files. And I think we're going to go with PDFs on the other ones. And I was just finishing up on the flame stitch with the flowers. So the Arbel one that's all cross stitch, that one's done and out. And then we did one that's thread channels, that's all done and out. And then I'm working on the flame stitch ones now, getting those finished. The models are all done and the patterns are written. I'm just working on the covers and the supply list. So it'll be soon.
Excellent.
Oh, nice. Nice. The flame stitch one is beautiful.
Yeah, I like both of those. The silk one is just so pretty, but the wool one, the colors are so vibrant. I love both of those. And then the wool one, I did a matching pinball because I collect pinballs and I have a little lecture I do on pinballs and I wanted a matching pinball to go with that one. So I couldn't resist using that pattern on a pinball.
Oh, what fun. So, yeah. So tell me about these sewing rolls. I'd never heard of these where it was just for storing thread. Is it just like little channels sewn into the cloth and you shove your thread in? How does that work?
Yeah. So before thread came retail on spools, you had to either, it came on skeins. So your choice was, or you were spinning your own thread. So your choice to keep it tidy was you could roll it in a ball. You could roll it on a thread winder. If you had some clamps, you could reel it onto a small spool of your own. And some of those 18th and 19th century spools are exquisite. There's mother of pearl, there's gold, there's silver ones. They're quite wonderful. Or you could use these fabric thread channels to put your threads through to keep them not only clean, but tidy so that they didn't become tangled. And then you kind of folded them in half, put them through the channel. And if you measure the lengths of the channels, it's about a 15 to 18 inch length of thread, which is a nice length to do your embroidery with. And you could pull out one strand at a time, and it left the other ones all nice and tidy in the channels.
Hmm.
Yeah, and actually I've seen someone on FlossTube showed one that was being reproduced for people who use the floss drops. And I always wondered what people did if you wanted to travel somewhere and you use those floss drops with the silk, you know, because you'd want it to, you don't want it to get all messed up, you know? You don't want it all.
Oh, so they're leaving them on the floss strap, but putting the tails down into like a fabric channel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And how do, how do you get that down there, though?
So that's kind of redundant because you wouldn't need the floss strap because you can just have the loop at the top of the channel. But anyway, historically that they didn't have anything at the top loop. So to get those in there, and there, the leather rolls also had thread channels. So they, leather being stiff, you can't scrunch it up like you could fabric. So they would use like the very long double-ended tools used for netting, and you can put the end loop in there and push it through the channel. You could make a loop in a bodkin. A bodkin was used for threading all the casings because a lot of your garments threaded closed. And then you just pull that through the fabric channel. And then several of the sewing rolls had bodkin holders stitched in the sewing roll. So bodkins were pretty handy tools during that time.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And, you know, your thread was pretty valuable. So then you could say you were using a length of thread and you didn't use all of it, but you might in the future, you had little thread winders and you could keep that little, you know, 5-6 inch tail and wrap it around a thread winder and drop the little thread winder in the pocket of your sewing roll. And you had it all neat and tidy in there and convenient.
I throw mine in an Oort bowl.
Yeah, and then we just toss them. And the other thing you'll find is they would gather them all up and stuff their pin cushions with them so nothing went unused or unwasted. And of
I
course,
throw mine in an Oort bowl and then throw them away. Oh, man. We're so wasteful.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Show some thread winders in the book, and you can see how tiny they are in proportion to the sewing roll, and you can get several yards of thread on one of the, I think some people even refer to them as snowflakes. They're just so tiny and petite, but you can get, especially if you're using silk or a fine linen thread, you can get several yards wound around a little thread winder. And yeah. Several yards in the thread channels.
What's that old thread like? Does it still hold up? I mean, you found some pieces of pretty old stuff.
Yeah, usually thread on wood spools doesn't because of the acidity in the wood. And it depends on how it was stored. We don't know where these came from, so we don't know if they were in a hot attic or, in my case, a freezing attic. We don't know what kind of life it had before us.
Yeah.
Definitely, that's probably the most common thing other than a thimble, that's found in these sewing rolls.
Ooh, a thimble. That'd be a find. Whoa.
Especially, yeah, some of the sterling ones, but usually the sellers kind of know that and they kind of raid the sewing roll before it goes, but or you can't be sure that's the original thimble if it had a style that has the thimble holder built into the sewing roll. You can't always be sure that's the original thimble that came with it.
Yeah,
and they were used over generations, so you don't know if it was, you know, grandmother's sewing roll with mother's thimble, or you know, how the pair came together, or if they, you know, wouldn't be unusual for someone to wear out a few thimbles in their lifetime.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I know you have one that was obviously a gift for someone that says like a present on it. Was it common to maybe gift those to a friend to make one, or like if you're getting married or like a sailor going away, would mom make one for the son who was getting ready to leave?
Yes, all of the above. So they were popular items like in fundraising fairs. They were something that was socially acceptable for you to spend your time making them. They were wonderful gifts for girls going off to school, boys going off to war, sweetheart gifts. Commemorative gifts. The Intarsia one is likely has some affiliation with a tailor and a soldier. And the one that says a present, that's possibly also from a soldier's tailor's wool. There's a leather one, I think, in my first book, and it was, it had a complete letter in it, and it was a gift. It was someone was going west, and when you left in the 19th century, say 1850, and you headed west, you didn't always see your family ever again. So these little gifts and mementos, you can imagine having that tucked in your sewing basket with that letter, how precious that was to have those memories of friends and family. And she says, you know, I'll probably never see you again. And, you know, I'll think of you often, and very sentimental.
That's so powerful, because, you know, these days, you know, we just chat online or whatever. We don't even think about it. But to think somebody's leaving town, you may never see them again just because they're going halfway across the country. Wow. That's.
Yeah. And not only that, is you wouldn't even necessarily have a picture. It's not even like right. They can just go have their picture taken and send it to you. And, or here's a picture of my firstborn. You know, it was, you know, really heading off into the unknown. So, having those letters and those pieces of history are important for us to think about.
Yeah. The gathered pocket, when we get to the gathered pocket designs, is that an evolution of design? Is that people who were more skilled, more talented, that were able to put those together? And then that seemed to me that it opened a door to just packing something with all kinds of things.
Yeah, I think part of it had to do with, when I started organizing the book, I thought about doing everything chronologically. And had I done that, we would have seen gathered pockets and the thread channels and that kind of mixed.
Oh, okay.
Some of it, I think, has to do with the availability of materials. So it would take a lot more fabric to do a gathered pocket. And they kind of, when they roll up, they aren't, they bulge out the sides, for lack of a better technical term. Which isn't so bad, because you can really pack a lot in there. And if it bulges out the side, it still stays together. So I think it was more personal preference and the supplies that you had to work with. Because some are all gathered pockets and some just have, you know, one pocket that isn't even really that full. So there's quite a variety within those two. Then you get into more of the style that has kind of a box at the end. And then I think there's one that was really a show off, and it has like 12 pockets in there.
Overachiever.
Yeah, you can see them walk in with their ladies group and they unroll theirs, and it just keeps unrolling, and there's like 12 pockets. Yeah.
And everybody rolls their eyes like, oh, geez.
Yeah. And it's got the scallop top and all the pretty things, but yeah.
Oh, that's Betty. Yeah, of course. Jeez. So these this book, now you self-published this one.
We did. I could
that
have
had
gone
to be
with
an
my
experience.
It was, but I think working with the publisher was an experience too. So we had a choice, and it was a hard choice to make. We weighed the pros and cons, and my family signed up to be major helpers and contributors to finishing this project. And we're really glad that we did it. It puts a lot more work on us, though, as far as everything falls to us then. So after getting the book done, there's the whole distribution and marketing and that aspect of it. So that's kind of the phase of the project that we're in right now, is getting the word out and getting it out to stores. And but we are selling copies ourselves too. So it's a wonderful experience. We've learned a lot. I think we would consider doing it again.
Oh, you would? Okay. I wondered if you would go back to a publisher, or if you'd the next one would be same path.
Yeah, I think looking at, it was scary clicking the send button to the printer
right.
and paying the printer's bill and everything. And then we got caught in the paper ink shortage, staffing mm-hmm. shortage of COVID. It sat with the printer more than 18 weeks. We were beginning to think we weren't going to get it at all. We missed all kinds of milestones we had planned for events and marketing and things we were going to do with it. And it was all out of our control. And people were really great about that. And I think everybody, for the most part, understands how difficult it was for businesses. And we chose a local printer in our community, a union shop, and everything's done in-house. And we're really glad that we could support our community that way, too. So we hung with them. And I pestered him every couple weeks or so, and we'd chat. And he knew about the events I had coming up, and he was trying. And right when we thought we were going to get it, COVID hit his shop, and he had to make his rounds through his staff. And then he called me one day, and he said, "I know you're traveling to this event this week, but I think there's a chance we can, you know, at least get you a few copies of the book." I'm like, "Great. And at the very least, we'll FedEx them to you. Great." And he called me the next day and he said, "You'll never believe this, but your books are done." So yeah. I don't know if they worked through the night or what they did, but we took a couple cars over and loaded up. I don't know, a couple tons. We had to calculate the load bearing weight of my SUV.
Oh my.
Yeah. Because it's one book is 2 pounds, and then you multiply that by a couple thousand, and it's like, whoa.
Yeah, I got it right here. Yep, it's 2 pounds. Yeah, it's a healthy 2 pounds. Yeah.
It is a nice book. I mean, it's. I have another friend that self-published. She always wanted to. So it's you. If I want a copy, you do a single print sort of thing. So it's very small. But I just can't imagine what you had to go through to get this all done. You know, the layout of the pages. Did anyone in your family have like editing experience?
Yeah. So that was one of our considerations. Is my daughter's a UX designer. My son-in-law is an artist and designer. My daughter-in-law is a UX designer. So we had lots of design input, lots of knowledge and publisher. So that was great. And they work full-time jobs. So this was always like just a secondary priority that we did kind of, you know, in our spare time, so to speak. All the photography had been done. I have a small photography studio in my home. My son-in-law is a professional photographer, so he helps consulting on, like the super extra long one that barely fit on the page. I think that's the Masonic one. He helped with ideas on that. And we talked about options for print on demand, but we felt really strongly that we wanted the quality to be really high. The photography and the high resolution was really important to me. So we could have done the book cheaper. We could have used different paper. So every aspect was a decision. So we had many interesting Saturday night pizza meals discussing our choices. Yeah.
Right. And I'm looking at the book. I mean, the fact that there's no clutter behind each of the images. I like that because then I can see what I'm looking at. I can see the needle roll. There's no like scrapbook paper behind it, sort of thing. It's nice to just see the image. Of what you're looking, you know, whatever the piece is. And I think that makes it much more interesting to look at each of these pieces. It is like you're looking at a museum of archive of these needle rolls.
Thank you. That was a goal that we had. We wanted a very clean aesthetic and we wanted people to feel like they could just reach out and touch it and get a sense of what what they are, if they've never had a chance to really examine one, or if they have and just, you know, wanted to remember what they were like. So thank you, because that was our goal. You know, we could have crammed more on a page, and we could have had a smaller book, but I wanted room for people to add notes if they came to any of the lectures, to, you know, make it their own too, with any sticky notes or anything they wanted to add in it. They could do that.
Yeah, mine's got sticky notes.
Oh, good.
I haven't written on my, yeah, now I've got to go back and take little notes on all my little sticky notes. So but anyway.
But no, visually, yeah, it's very comfortable to look at. No, you guys did a real good job of, it's, you can focus on the element for that spread and not feel like there's eight other things drawing your attention. No, it's very nicely done. Yeah.
Yeah, and then on the cover is the front of the rolls, and then the back cover is the back of the rolls. So that was a little,
oh,
a little,
I missed that.
A little, a little parody. Yeah.
Look at that.
Oh, yeah.
Well played.
Excellent.
Well played. And if it's any comfort, in my day job, I'm a magazine editor, and it was what, 4 or 5 months ago, and we used probably the biggest print house in the country. And 4 or 5 months ago, we got an email when we sent that issue to the printer. We can't get your paper. It's going to be delayed 4 or 5 days because we just can't get paper. So,
yeah,
and that's the biggest print house in the country. Yeah, it's everybody everywhere. Yep.
Yeah, and it was the balance of, oh, we have the ink but not the paper. Oh, we have the paper but not the ink. Oh, you know, do you want it? Could you do a different paper? No, I think, you know, we want to stick with what we originally planned. So yeah, I hope more people will understand that with everything. I mean, linens and threads and what these small shops and businesses have gone through to stay in business. We really need to take care of them.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's just it. When you're printing magazines, books, whatever it is, people don't think about the ink. I mean, there's large quantities of ink that have to be acquired in the proper mixture and the paper with the right coating on it and the right weight. And, yeah, you don't just grab a bunch of copy paper off the shelf and start running them through presses. It's a major undertaking. And, printers used to, I've been doing magazines a long time, you know, they used to have warehouses full of paper, massive rolls of paper, and they don't store them anymore. They don't store paper because they don't want the inventory tied up, and they don't store ink. And so when they have a job, they acquire what they need for that job. And when we get a pandemic and supply chains are all broken up, it really gets to be tough. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're trying to keep their employees busy, but they have nothing they can print. And
right.
So we did some backwards things. We said, okay, well, could you do some bookmarks? And so we did some smaller pieces for marketing that we thought we would do after, we ended up doing before. We just pieced it together as best we could, and we're really happy with how it all came out.
Well, yep. In the end, you win. It's very nice. Mm-hmm. Very nice book.
Thank
you. Yep.
Thank you.
All right. So very nice book. Where can we get it?
Oh, I am so lucky. I have shops from the East Coast. I hate to start naming them because I'll forget somebody, but pretty much any local needlework shop, Sassy Jack's, Hobby House, The Attic, Florida, Texas, the San Francisco School of Needlework and Design, their gift shop has it. There's a shop in the Netherlands. You can get copies directly from me, or you can contact me and I'll help you find a shop near you that has it. Stitchville here is my local needlework shop in Minneapolis. So I'm very lucky that it's getting out there to lots of people.
Great. And you didn't mention that A word, so that means we're supporting local shops, yes.
That's right. We purposely did that. based on my experience with my first book. So I can promise you it's not going to go on sale if you're waiting. It's not going to be discounted by a big distributor. We'd rather sell fewer copies and support our small businesses than the A words. So that's the way it's going to be.
That's
excellent.
Good.
And you're selling. So for those of us who are scared to start making our own, you're selling PDF charts on your, I can't think of the name.
So in our Etsy shop, Collector with a Needle, we have PDF patterns. If you're interested in the thread channels, there's a PDF for that. We have the chart pack and finishing instructions for our bell there. That is probably one of the more basic kind of cross stitch ones on linen. And then hopefully in the next week or two, I'll have the Bargello ones out from that chapter as well. And then I have some embroidered ones that didn't make the book that are fantastic, that will be special events coming up with some shops and guilds over the next year or two. Stay tuned because there's more coming. So
excellent.
Yes. And you do lectures too. So people can contact you about getting a lecture on.
Yeah. I do Zoom programs. I have done in person, but honestly, the smalls almost show up better on a PowerPoint on your screen. But I have done the Sewing Roll one in person with a workshop. But I do guild programs. And like I said, I'll be working with a few shops. I'll be in San Francisco at the end of the month doing an in-person. They're doing kind of a walk-in, like bring your embroidery in and let's talk about it thing. And I'm doing a little talk on the sewing rolls there. Just contact me about any program and I'll let you know what we can do.
Outstanding. Well, congratulations on your second book, and it's a good one. Folks, go buy it. You'll enjoy it. It's really good. Don, congratulations, and thanks for talking with us, and thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always so fun to talk to you guys. You're so fun. So thank you. We appreciate it.